I was looking forward to today with a great deal of anticipation. It's actually sort of a continuation of our talk from last week. It really touches on what I think is the most profound truth in the Dharma teachings. The root of suffering, what causes suffering in the world. For some, it's regarded as something of a difficult topic because conceptually it really touches to some basic, fundamental core teachings of the Dharma. To understand the logic of how we suffer and why we suffer, and the consequent sort of antidote to suffering in terms of liberation from suffering, which is the foundation teaching of the Dharma, in order to sort of embody or understand that logic, it really is important to understand these basic fundamental concepts. And they have to do with the idea of self. And if you extend that out, it also has to do with our perception of reality, how we see reality. And I guess the subject of the talk is really this differentiation, or how to see the difference between what we call conventional reality, which is the reality that we see all around us, and what in the teaching is called absolute reality or ultimate reality. When I say ultimate reality, that concept has counterparts in other faith traditions, and commonly it would be seen as this dichotomy between what is called the sacred and the profane, or the secular and the divine, or material and spiritual, so that sort of differentiation. So in the Christian tradition, it would be seen as the secular world and the divine world. And depending on what words you use to describe it, in modern Christianity it's called the ground of being, where divine presence or the sacred Godhead is really seen as being that which underlies all being. So it's not necessarily some old man with a long beard sitting on a throne with a trident, someplace in heaven. But it's really something that pervades all existence. So called the ground of being. Now, that has a counterpart in the Buddhist tradition as the notion of the Dharma, that which underlies all things, which is the ultimate reality of all things. Now, that ultimate reality is different from the reality that we see with our eyes and ears and nose in our everyday lives. So this is, the attempt here is to sort of explain this difference so that we can get a handle on this whole notion of what suffering is and how to free ourselves from suffering. Now, the whole topic sort of derives from our discussion of the four foundations of mindfulness. And in our discussion, we were talking about the body, the physical body, the components of the physical body. So these are subjects of meditation. In the classical training, we have these four foundations. One is the body, one is the feelings, one is consciousness itself. So these are the aspects of the mind-body experience that are subjects, that become subjects for meditation in the meditative practice. So we're talking about the body. And the idea of the body is that the first sort of contemplation of the body is to contemplate the body as a package of constituent parts. So you have the heart, the stomach, the liver, the spleen, the intestines, the bones, the skin. Okay, the second part is to see the body as what are called elements. Now, what these elements are, there are four elements: the earth, water, air, and fire. In essence, we start to see ourselves as a physical biopsychophysical process. Psycho in the sense of mental processes and physical in the sense of physical processes, right? So, the reality of what we are is that of a physical process comprised of parts, systems, sensations, feelings, and elements. It has nothing to do with me as a self, right? If we see ourselves as a whole that has specific shapes, and you know, it could be fat, it could be skinny, it could be, you know, tall or short, or handsome or not handsome, or beautiful or not beautiful, depending on all our sort of socially conditioned norms of judgment, right? So we see a self. I see me, I see Gregory, right? You know, I see John, I see Harry, I see, you know, Christine or Mary, right? Because they're associated with this particular shape, this particular whole entity that walks and talks and, you know, drives a car and, you know, does all the things that this body does. And in that sense, every body is different. Every body is different. The hair color is different, you know, the clothes are different, the features are different. And some are beautiful according to, you know, culturally conditioned, you know, rules of what is beautiful and not beautiful. And some are ugly, and some are desirable, and some are undesirable. You see what I'm saying? So we have this whole set of rules that define our perception of ourself and other selves depending on the shape and configuration of this body. Right? So we are identified and we create a sense of self based on this body as well as the bodies of others. So it depends on whether I relate to someone with lust and desire or aversion and hatred, you know. And it could be not only physical, it could be religious, it could be social, it could be political, it could be economic, it could be, you know. So in other words, these are all socially conditioned ways of seeing the world. It creates difference, it creates separation, it creates self, and it creates other. So this is the conventional world. This is the world in which we live. And we orient to each other as wholes, as whole entities. But if we saw ourselves as body parts and body systems and elements and feelings, right, there's no heart that's Gregory's heart or Gregory's stomach. My stomach is no different from anybody else's stomach, whether they're Chinese, Japanese, you know, or African, or Latin American, or Caucasian. A stomach's a stomach. A heart's a heart. A leg is a leg. A liver is a liver. Right? There's no association with self. A respiratory system is a respiratory system. I'm feeling heaviness or lightness, whoever I am, whatever I feel is universal across all cultures, all species. So if we see ourselves as physical processes, this notion of self literally disappears. There's no self because we're all the same. We're all subject to the same processes of, you know, birth, growth, life, death. We're all subject to diseases. We're all subject to aging, fear, happiness, sadness, grief, loss of parents, you know, sort of unfortunate circumstances, wonderful circumstances, good, bad, whatever. It makes absolutely no difference whether we're American, European, African, Asian, you know, we're all subject to the same processes. So there's a dimension in which we're all the same. We're no different. And there's a dimension in which we're all different and not the same. So this is the difference between what we call absolute reality and conventional reality. That's pretty simple. Right? It's just the way you see things. It's just the way you see things. So this is a key kind of distinction in the way we see the world. And obviously, the psychological sort of impact of seeing, you know, the world in a conventional way is completely different from when you see the world you know, in this absolute way. Because when there's a self, sense of self, all of a sudden there's a self, there's a sense of survival, safety, defense, protection, right? Aggrandizement, my pleasure, my desires, my pains, the things that I like, the things that I don't like, and this, all of a sudden, you know, desire and aversion and all of these dynamics of selfing start to arise. So the question is, how can we see ourselves in ways that bring into relationship this larger view of reality, right? This larger view of reality, while not erasing or gainsaying this more conventional view, but in a way sort of deepening it, sort of balancing it, you know, with this other view that allows us to have a wider perspective in terms of who we are as human beings in the world. But how do you do it with that wider sense of perspective and wisdom that understands that while we are separate human beings, we're all part of a universal interconnected process that unites us all in one common experience as a human being. Which then, of course, allows for compassion. It allows for love. It allows for wisdom and understanding to come into our lives and balance, you know, the more Darwinian aspects of our behavior. Then, you know, that often pop up, you know, as a matter of, you know, human survival. So, this idea of absolute and conventional reality touches on the notion of the void or emptiness. Now, many of you have heard of this term, particularly in Mahayana context, or sort of Tibetan Buddhism, or Zen Buddhism. Now, so what I want to do is to get into some of these terms and sort of define them within the context of this larger subject that we're talking about in terms of absolute and conventional reality. Now, there's a very famous passage from a book called The Path of Purification. And it goes like this. And this has to do with the four elements. So, you know, this is how it ties into this whole notion of sensations, you know, the elements in the body. The monk who is devoted to defining the contemplation of the four elements, okay, immerses himself in voidness and eliminates the perception of living being. Eliminates the perception of living beings. Because he has abolished the perception of living beings, he conquers fear and dread, and conquers delight and aversion. He is not exhilarated or depressed by agreeable or disagreeable things. And as one of great understanding, he ends in the deathless realm, or is bound for a happy destiny. Through contemplation of the four elements, we immerse ourselves in voidness and eliminate the perception of human beings. Now that's pretty radical in terms of our understanding of ourselves in the world. And through this contemplation of the voidness and the perception of living beings, we open the door to this overarching sort of principle of relative and ultimate truth. Relative truth, or conventional truth, is the world we live in. The world of concept, the world of subject and object, of self and other, of birth and death. All the familiar experiences of our lives are contained within this domain of relative truth. So this is the conventional world in which we live. Ultimate truth sees the world quite differently. In the level or domain of ultimate truth, there is no subject or object separation. In fact, there are no things at all. And we'll get into this, what this means. In the very deepest aspect of ultimate truth, we could call it the unmanifest or the unborn, the undying. All the words that the Buddha used to describe Nibbana. It's that which is not born, that which is, does not die, that which is not manifest, that which is no thing. This is ultimate truth. Okay, so this is how it's described. So on the relative level in our lives, we live and we act and we relate as individuals, as one individual to another. And this is a big part of our lives, with all our personal stories, all our personal histories, and our personal narratives. And on the ultimate level of understanding, we see that there's no self. There is no self. There's no I. There's no one there. That it's all a play of body parts, systems, momentary changing elements and sensations. That's all that's going on. And yet, out of this process that we are, we create this story, this drama, that is our lives. Right? So they're like two sides of a blade, right? There's one side which is the reality of what we really are. You know, it's a thing where it's a what. But out of that what, we create a who. And that who is who we are. Our stories, our narratives, you know, our dramas. Whether it's be, you know, whatever that drama might be, it's our personal narrative that we create out of this process, out of this what of what we are. So, you know, these are two dimensions of one process. So these are the two aspects of one thing. Now, in the Sutta Nipata, which is another sutta, these are very provocative sort of writings. The Buddha points out this very directly and gives us the instructions for practicing freedom. He said, dry out that which is past. I love that phrase, dry out that which is past. You know, basically kind of let it go. Let there be nothing for you in the future. If you do not grasp and anything in the present, you will go about at peace. One who, in regard to this entire mind-body complex, has no cherishing of it as me or mine, and who does not grieve for what is non-existent, truly suffers no loss in the world. For him, there's no thought of anything as this is mine or this is another's, not finding any state of ownership and realizing nothing is mine, he does not grieve. Now, the one line that really jumps out is don't grieve for what is non-existent. Non-existent. It's like a wake-up call. What we are doing is really like a dream. Even in tense situations, they may be intense on the relative level, but if we can touch even briefly or even for a few moments, just open to us the possibility of an understanding on the ultimate level, that takes us beyond the concept of being, of a self. Then we don't grieve for what is non-existent. The mind is at peace. Now, in the literature, or in the practice, this is called disenchantment. Disenchantment, right? What does disenchantment mean? It means, demythification. You know, we're enchanted. You know, we live in this world of enchantment, of illusory, of this illusion of a self. We're enchanted by the sense of a self. And once we start to understand the reality of what we really are, we become disenchanted. We literally begin to step away from our grasping and holding on and clinging and craving, right? Because, well, we see that we're just a process. You know, there's no one there, actually. It's just an illusion. I mean, I may think I'm somebody, but basically, fundamentally, I'm just a psychophysical process. So I don't have to take myself so seriously, right? I don't have to be so self-absorbed and like, you know, like John Kabat-Zinn says, you know, see myself as the central fulcrum around which the universe turns. Right? You know, it's not like that at all. It's just the opposite. I'm not only not central, I'm pretty insignificant as far as the flow of the universe is concerned. So it changes the way we see ourselves. This fundamental understanding of ultimate reality. Now, one of the best examples, and this is a very powerful example, is the story of the death of the 16th Karmapa, who was the head of one of the great Tibetan lineages, who died about some 17 or 18 years ago. Now, he was here in the United States. When he was dying, his body was riddled with cancer. He was in a hospital in Chicago. And his disciples were all around him. And they were, you know, obviously very upset that this great master and beloved teacher was dying. And so there was a lot of weeping and a lot of wailing. He turned to all his grieving disciples and said, "Don't worry. Nothing is happening. Don't worry. Nothing is happening." Now that's a remarkable statement. Here's this body doing all this stuff. But from his perspective, it's like, of the ultimate level, nothing is happening. If we understand what he's saying, we begin to touch and begin to experience this level of understanding of ultimate reality. This is when we begin to free ourselves from the grip of conventional reality, from the grip of, you know, that sense of self, that illusion, you know, of the world in which we live. The world as we know it is basically an optical illusion. It's basically an optical illusion in the sense that it's a function of the way we see it. Literally, the way we see it. Literally. Okay? So how do we see the world? Right? We see the world as solid objects. You know, bodies, you know, buildings, and so we assign a word for that object. A tree, dog, man, woman, boy, girl, you know, etc., etc., etc. So, first of all, we see a solid object, and then we create a word that denotes that object. So on one level, we're simplifying our apprehension of reality, right, by seeing it as an object. And then we're creating a concept to denote that object, like a word. A word is a concept, right? So we're living at increasingly refined levels of abstraction. So in the sense that, you know, I see your body as a body, right? So that's one level of abstraction, right? It's not, I don't see it as body parts or systems or feelings or, you know, I see it as an object, right? And then I put a name on that object, woman. And then perhaps you have a name, right? So there's a name that goes with that object. And so in my mind, you know, you are that object with that name. So how I relate to you is basically as a concept and an object. So at a relatively highly defined level of abstraction. Right? So we're dealing in a level of concepts and objects. Right? This is how we orient to the world. But the reality of the world is far different. You know, it's not that, you know, it's not just you as a body, but you as a psychophysical process. If I look at a tree, is the tree the visual representation of the tree, or is it some, you know, complex photosynthetic process? Obviously, you know, at the level of ultimate truth, it's a very complex biological photosynthetic process. But do we see that? No, of course not. We have no idea that. All we see is, you know, a vertical brown piece with little things that come out and leaves on the top. And we have that picture in our mind and we call it a tree. See, this is what I mean. So we live in an optically illusory world. We're just seeing the surface of things. Everything in the world is not what we see. So, for example, in the Buddhist teachings, there are two sort of fallacies. The two fallacies are, one is the fallacy of continuity, and the other one is the fallacy of compactness. The fallacy of continuity is that, for example, when you have a thought, right, it's like you think you're thinking a continuous thought, you know, a continuous action, like this person is going here, and then he says this to that person, and that happens, and this occurs, and that occurs, and, you know, a whole narrative unfolds in your mind about a certain circumstance. Well, the reality is that that's not how the mind works. The mind works in mind segments, in mind moments. We have these, you know, what are called cittas, or mind moments, and these mind moments can be about a tenth of a second long, and they just unfold in these nanosecond segments. And this is how the mind actually works. This has been neurobiologically proven. So our mind sort of, it goes along and it can shift direction depending on the circumstances of the moment. You see what I'm saying? So we're having a thought, you know, oh, I'm enjoying sitting in this hot tub and something, and all of a sudden somebody comes along with a siren and blows it in my ear, right? It's like that noise of that drilling. Right? And all of a sudden, oh, my thought process goes this way, right? And then all of a sudden it stops, it's, oh, okay, it goes back this way, I'm feeling better, right? You see what I'm saying? This is how the mind works, right? So how our thoughts go depend on whatever circumstances are coming on, or how I'm predisposed to think. You know, if I'm a very hypersensitive, high-strung, hyper-tense person, I'll just freak out, right? Or if I'm not, I say, oh, that's interesting. You know, so how we think is determined by so many thoughts, and they unfold in these nanoseconds. So this is a way of understanding karma, right? This is understanding how the thought process works, how we're conditioned to think in a certain way, and we're influenced by certain external factors. Boom, 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 boom. And then those thoughts become intentions, they become emotions, they become actions, and boom, before you know it, we can do something either murderously unskillful or beautifully skillful and compassionate and loving. See, but it all starts on how the mind works, right? So this is the fallacy of continuity. Now the fallacy of compactness is that we see things as compact and whole and real. But in fact, they're not. And this, we know this from science. For example, I mean, one example is, I always use, is a table. You look at a table, and it's got, there are four legs, and there's a flat surface on the top, and it's painted a certain color. And we have a word for it, table. And in our mind, that object, that concept, fulfills a certain purpose. And it's fine, it's what it is. But if you look at that table, at one level down, you see it's not what it is, it's actually molecules, right? They're actually wood molecules. Then if you go one step down, they're actually atoms. And then the atoms, you know, devolve to electrons and protons. And then if you go down even further, they devolve to quarks and gluons, and, you know, we're down into the quantum world, right? And it's just basically raw energy. So what is the table, right? Is it this shape and object that we see, or is it the atoms, the molecules, or the electrons, protons, or the gluons and the quarks, and raw, you know, E equals MC squared, pure energy. It's everything. It's all of the same thing, right? It's just that we perceive it only at one level. So, you know, that's what I mean when I say optical illusion. We see the world as compact and the mind as continuous, but in fact, that's not the way it actually is. The mind isn't that way and the world isn't that way. It's really a process. What is the world but a process? In the sense of coming into being, existing for a period of time, and then eventually going out of existence. Birth, life, and death. Everything is subject to the law of birth, life, and death. Everything. Including the universe, including the galaxy, including the Milky Way. It's just that the time sequence varies from, you know, the life cycle of a firefly, which might be, you know, 2 hours, you know, to the life cycle of a galaxy, which might be 14 billion years. But it's the same process. Life, maturation, and death, arising and passing away. So if we're looking at, you know, an insect or a dog or a 1,000-year-old tree or an ant or a piece of concrete, right? All of these objects are in a process of change. It's just that the time cycles are different. So, in a way, you know, the Dharma, you know, the Dharma, or what we call, is what we call nature. And what is nature but all this entirety of the reality of all things as they are, which goes on irrespective of how we see it. It has nothing to do with how we see it. So we, as Homo sapiens, have created this entire narrative of a civilization, of a culture, of a species that's all in our brains. But it has nothing to do with the reality of how things actually are in the world. So this is the definition of illusion. This is the definition of not seeing things as they really are. Now, it doesn't mean it's bad. You know, does not constitute a moral judgment. It's just simply the way it is. You know, so we have to see the world in an objective way in order to survive, in order to be in the world. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here as a species, you know, of Homo sapiens. So it is necessary for us to exercise, you know, our minds, have concepts, thoughts, language, you know, systems of abstraction to order the world and our understanding of the world. But it's also important to know that that's not the only thing that there is. That there is a whole other reality. It's the other 99% of the iceberg that's below the level of the water. We only see the 1% at the top of the water, but we don't see the other 99% that's down there below, which is really the total reality of what's there. So, this is what it means. So if you understand ultimate reality, so for example, okay, getting back to this idea of self, right? Do you think the molecule in the table, or do you think that your liver or your kneecap, you know, has an idea that of me and mine and who I am? Of course not, right? There's no sense of self in the body part. You know, there's no sense of I am a table in the wood molecule that's sitting in the leg of the chair, right, of the table. There's no sense of, you know, what am I? I'm just an electron. I'm just a proton. I'm just a molecule. I'm just this and that, and I'm doing my thing at this level of existence, right? So there's no sense of this larger conceptual reality that defines the totality of all us molecules, you know, running around at this level of existence. So from my perspective, in the realm of ultimate reality, there is no self. You see what I'm saying? It depends on how you look at it. There's no self. All of that stuff out there is void. It's non-existent. There's nothing there. It's just me and my molecule friends, right? Ellen the electron and Peter the proton, you know, in their little dance, right? We're doing down here doing our thing. We're comprising this thing that they call wood, but, you know, I have no concept of a table, right? Or this kneecap or this liver has no concept of Gregory Pye, who's living this narrative. They're just doing their job as my digestive system or as my kneecap or as my... You see what I'm saying? So if you're looking at it from the point of view of ultimate reality, there is no self. There is no being there. It's just this process that's unfolding in time and space. It's just this body that's going on and on. The digestive, the respiratory, the circulatory. It's just going along doing its thing. There's no concept of a being there. That's what it means. You see, no self. From that perspective, there is no self. So if you understand it from that perspective, it's really simple, right? It depends on how you look at it. But if you're looking at it from the point of view of conventional reality and you say no self, that's like a contradiction in terms. How can there be no self if I'm here, right? And that's how we understand, that's how we get stuck on this term no self, because we're looking at it from a conventional point of view. If I'm here, how can there be no self? No, you're there, but there's the self. If you see yourself as this process, there is no self, because it's just a process. So, you know, this is the way to begin to. So if you see the world in that way, in terms of that distinction between this optical reality and the absolute reality, so in a way it's a kind of virtual reality, right? It is a virtual reality. It's just appearance of things as they are. It's a virtual reality. It is a virtual reality. It's not really real. It's virtual. So what's below the real things are all these processes of rising and passing away. And systems, you know, in motion, constantly changing, constantly impermanent, constantly transforming, transmuting from one to the other. This is the reality of what's going on. This is the Dharma. This is the ground of being. This is the fullness that constitutes the totality of all life. And we don't see it, because all we see is virtual reality. So we're all, you know, we're going along with virtual reality goggles on. And we don't see the reality that's behind everything we see. Now, one of the things I wanted to touch on is how this plays out at the mental realm and at the physical realm of our bodies. Now, the physical realm is pretty easy to understand, because we've basically been talking about that. In other words, we're not this total whole, you know, object, but we're body parts, we're systems, we're feelings, we're energy, you know. So, you know, that we can see that dichotomy very clearly, right? So it's not difficult to understand. But the mental part is very interesting, and it's not something that's commonly discussed. What is it in our mental processes that we can define as real and illusory? Okay, so in our physical processes, we can define it easily, right? The what is real is our body as a psychophysical process, and what is illusory is the sense of a separate, irreducible, stable, independent self, right? That's what the illusory part is. Now, in terms of our mental processes, what is it that's real and what is it that's illusory? Now, I would submit that what is real in our mental processes are our emotions, what we feel in the body. Like, for example, sensations, right? Sensations are real. Somebody's, you know, sticks a sharp object in your skin, you feel it. You know, if you're walking down and you see a tiger in the bush about to pounce on you, that's real. You're being born. You have the experience of giving birth to a child. You know, the pain and the ecstasy and the agony of giving birth, that's real. Or you're going through the end of a life cycle, you're reaching the end of a life, you're feeling, the dissipation of energy, the decline in your faculties, that's real. These are all real things. In other words, the things that are happening to our bodies as part of our physical life biological process, right, those are real. And the emotions that we feel as a result of that. If we're feeling fear, anxiety, happiness, joy, pleasure, satisfaction, or grief, whatever we're feeling, these are natural sort of consequences of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. For example, fear is a very healthy thing. I mean, if you're encountering something dangerous, something physically threatening, fear is a good emotion to have because it removes you from the source of danger, from the source of hurt. So having fear is not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. And it's a very real response, to our circumstance. But what is not real are the thoughts that we build around our emotion. In other words, the stories that we create around our emotions. That's what gets fabricated out of the raw material of our emotions. See, so there's a difference. There's a difference between what we actually feel as emotions, between the stories and narratives that we create around our experience. That's when it gets personal, right? That's when it gets, it's woe is me, or I'm smarter, or I'm stupider, or I don't know this, or I don't know that, or that stupid so-and-so did this to cause this to happen to me. And, so we build these entire stories around our emotional experience. But we don't, and we, out of those stories that we create, that's what creates our experience. You see what I mean? That's what creates our narrative. That's what creates our self-perception of ourselves in our circumstance. And whether that self-perception is that of victimization or suffering or, abuse or whatever, that's what it is, that's what it is that we become. And that becomes the ground of suffering. Now, how does that suffering emerge? It emerges how we interpret our experience. You see what I'm saying? The experience is there. I may have cancer. Or I may have a car accident. That's real. And I have pain, I broke a leg, or I had some kind of complications. That's real. I have to have a medical procedure to, fix my broken ribs. That's real. That's all real. And the pain I feel and the emotions that I feel as a result of that are all real. But then, what if I start building, I should have gotten insurance, I didn't buy insurance, now I have to pay all this money, and then I have to go, borrow money from my uncle so I can pay my medical bills, do I have, VA medical, or, these stories just start to unfold, and before you know it, it's not just about dealing with the accident, the car accident. It's about dealing with all the stuff that you're burdening yourself around in your experience. Now, in the Buddhist teaching, there's a teaching of the two darts. The teaching of the two darts. And this is really essential to understand in terms of the etiology of suffering. If a dart hits you, you're hit by a dart and you feel pain, you can't avoid the pain. The pain is there. I feel pain. That's the experience that you're actually experiencing. But if, on the other hand, I feel the pain and then I build on top of that physical pain this story of anguish that, so-and-so is just an evil person. He did it to me. He doesn't like me. He threw this arrow and it penetrated me. It's causing me suffering. I'm gonna, I'm going to go and kill his wife and, you know, seek revenge on his family and, you know, and, you know, call the cops and sue him, you know, sue the bastard and get all kinds of, you know, so you're building this huge edifice, you know, you're feeding that pain with all of this narrative, thoughts that create the suffering. You can't avoid the suffering of the arrow that hits you. But it's the, and that, what you, that narrative that you create around that suffering is called the second dart. So you're shooting yourself with another dart. And that is your mind, your thoughts, all the narrative that, the stories that you build around your experience, how you interpret your experience. So if you, the suffering that we experience, the classic suffering that we experience in our lives is the second dart. It's not the first dart. Because you cannot avoid the first dart. The first dart will hit you. You will get sick. You will die. You will have misfortune. These things will occur. You can't avoid it. It's part of life. So that's real. You know, you can't avoid that. That's ultimate reality. But what you can avoid, and what is what is illusory, and those are all the stories that we build around our experience. So the essence of wisdom, right, the essence of, which is revealed in the meditative process, is to see the stories that we build around our experience and the consequences that these stories have for us going down the line. You know, because this particular story might lead to unskillful, harmful actions to myself and other people, or it may not. It may lead to wholesome, positive results. So, you know, it's okay. But if the story that we're building creates more suffering and more anguish and more angst for myself, then that's what suffering is. And that's what I've created out of my experience. On the other hand, if I have the ability to mindfully be aware of the actual experience of pain that I experienced because of that first dart, then there are ways to release myself from that suffering so that I don't suffer from that either. So this is really the crux of the practice. So what is real, you know, in our experience are, you know, the circumstances that we encounter in our lives, you know, because we will encounter, you know, illness, accidents, catastrophes, unforeseen disasters, earthquakes, you know, tsunamis, fires, thefts. These things happen. We can't avoid it. So the essence of wisdom is to deal with these emotions, the consequences, directly as they are, without building these great narratives, these great stories around our experience that create more suffering for us as well as for others. So from a mental point of view, this is how we begin to differentiate, you know, between what is real and what is illusory. And it's what is illusory, you know, that causes suffering. That is the cause of suffering for us in the world. So the essence of wisdom is this ability to differentiate between real experience and the stories that we create around our experience. So ultimately, what we define as wisdom, you know, in the classic Buddhist sense, is this ability to balance our understanding of conventional reality and our understanding of ultimate reality. So we know we live in a conventional world, but we also know that conventional world is to an extent delusory, and that there are other factors that determine what we perceive, you know, in the conventional world. So we see the world in a balanced way, that it's, yes, we do need to survive, we need to raise a family, I need to have a job, I need to, you know, compete in the labor market, or, you know, in whatever ways it's necessary for me to survive as a human being. But on the other hand, there's a part of me that allows for a sense of grace, a sense of wisdom, a sense of spaciousness, a sense of forgiveness and acceptance of my circumstance as well as other people's circumstance. You know, a sense of empathy, interconnectedness. Because I know that I'm not alone. Everybody else is the same. So I see a sense of brotherhood or sisterhood in my experience with the experience of other people. And this is where empathy, you know, sympathy, compassion begins to arise. When we see ourselves in this larger context in terms of, you know, absolute reality. So, in essence, if you were to look at this from a Christian point of view, you would see the divinity and the sacredness of all life. Even if, you know, there's a conventional veneer, there's this virtual reality that we live in, but that virtual reality is suffused with divinity, with a sacredness. In a Buddhist context, you could say that it's suffused with, you know, unconditional reality, unconditional truth, the Dharma. The Dharma flows through all things. So, you know, it allows us this sense of expansiveness and grace and wisdom and compassion. Even though we live in the real world, we live, you know, in a spiritual way, you know, to use the term. This is what it means, you know, spiritual in the sense of un- or non-conventional, you know, non-virtual reality. Okay, thank you all very much.